everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Constructive Criticism. I'm your host, Spencer, and I am joined by my co-hosts, a man who was in third place in the World Magic Cup in Canada, John Stern.
All right, did we actually check that? I mean, I might have been fourth.
All we know is that Seth is going and we're not, John, because we're unlucky, and Seth is clearly more lucky than us. That's the only reason it could be, right, Seth?
I'm not sure if I want to get into the details about the reasoning. I was told by someone that if I was the World Magic Cup captain for the U.S., then that must mean I was the player of the year. So I've gotten those daggers before.
Oh, man. Yeah. That is a dagger. That is a dagger.
Because normally it's so hard to be the captain for the U.S. team that you just like are player of the year by default.
I don't know who would ever dagger you about not being player of the year. I don't think that's never happened on this podcast. So, you know, awkward.
Let me just pull out the daggers from my back real quick so I can forget about them and acknowledge your statement.
You know who won't dagger you, though, Seth, is our sponsor, Oasis Games. You can check them out at MTG Oasis. You can get 15% off of your first order by using the code WouldThatBeGood at checkout. Or that's not even true. It's CCMTG at checkout. You can get 4% off of every order by using the code WouldThatBeGood. You can check out our other sponsor, Deen Gaming. You can get a percentage off by using the code CCMTG10. And then they give us a little bit of kickback so you know, we can get a sweet backdrop for John or you know, stuff like that.
Oh, you didn't like the weapons.
The weapons were sweet. You left Vegas.
Yeah, I'm back in Victoria. No weapons.
No weapons.
I need some help with my backdrop. I could use a few more trophies if there's a little extra.
Oh, now who's throwing daggers? You can check out the rest of our network at constructivecriticism.com. We added a new podcast this week in the form of The Hive Mind. The Hive Mind is a bi-weekly Magic podcast highlighting different members of the Magic community. It's the first interview show that we've had on the network, so I highly recommend checking them out, as well as everything else. Go click on podcast on constructivecriticism.com, see what's going on there. You can also support the podcast directly by going to patreon.com/ccmtg to become a patron of the show. We have a ton of new patrons in the last week. We really appreciate them. It makes doing this a lot easier, and we really, really appreciate it. There will be a contest winner announced for the patrons next week. Announced this right before John and Seth joined the show, but basically any patrons are eligible, and we're just going to give out a playset of any card in Standard. I have some sponsorship money lying around. We're gonna give that to our patrons because we appreciate you so much. So if you're not a Patreon yet, or you're not a patron yet, you can go to patreon.com, be eligible for that, and we'll give those out next week. And then we're starting a new contest in December in the Discord. So if you go to the Heezy Game Media Discord, we're going to do a couple of things. Most 4-1 or better screenshots in the 4-1 or better decklist channel in there, as well as some other additional contests. We're going to give out a swag bag of Constructive Criticism swag. So check that out. Go to patreon.com for the contest this month, and then next month we'll be giving out some swag. So head on over to the Discord. If you are a patron, though, Seth, you get to ask a question for the question of the week. And this week, for our always improving question is, what is the best way to do testing while operating solo? How do you get the most out of your testing when you don't have anyone to work with? And John, this is something you've been trying more, or you specifically tried it for the last Pro Tour. So why don't you take the first stab at this one?
Well, yeah. So the past two Pro Tours, I worked by myself. For the past three, I was mostly by myself. For one of them, I worked with two other people. So the big difference is that you can't just rely on someone else to figure things out for you. Like when I've been on teams, there's always a few people who are self-motivated and other people who are working hard and willing to do whatever. But in the end, they're sort of outsourcing their decision-making to some, like I'm sure Seth has had experience with this, where like, 2 days before the PT, there's five people saying, I'm going to do whatever you do. And that happens kind of on every team where there's like, well, I'm not sure if this deck is good. You know, what do you think, PV, or what do you think, Sam, or whatever? But when you're on your own, that's not a possibility, really. So you need to be really, for what I did basically is I sort of compartmentalized the planning and the testing, whereas I'm going to take some time every day to make sure that I'm on track for narrowing down my deck decision, making sure I understand the limited format, doing all the things like sort of taking control of the testing process. Whereas on a team, everyone sort of just does something. As long as they're doing something productive, that's good. So it's more important when you're on your own to sort of prioritize and be very decisive. So if like you play a league with a deck and you're like, I don't really think this deck is good or worth the time, you just stop. That's it. That deck's out. You're not going to consider it. And sometimes you'll be making the wrong decision, but if you sort of follow every thread till its endpoint, you're going to run out of time. So I guess that would be my advice.
And
prioritize and be decisive.
And I don't even think it matters if that's just the Pro Tour, right? Like let's say you're testing for a PPTQ or an RPTQ, right? Like modern RPTQs are coming up. There's no way you have time to test every modern deck by yourself. That's just not going to happen. And you have to, I mean, there's some amount of trust in your gut that has to happen in Magic when you're testing by yourself.
Yeah, I think, and also when it's something like an RPTQ, I think people are more willing to just talk to whoever, but when you're in a random conversation, you're not getting the same intensity of analysis that you would when you're like testing for a Pro Tour. So I still, even if I'm sharing information, I still want to sort of make sure that I'm taking care of myself, making sure that I'm ready.
Yeah. Seth, what about you? How would you answer this question?
Well, I have a little bit of a different background in recent years in that for Pro Tours, I have tended to work with a team. But even then, when you're working with a team, for a tournament, you still have to do a certain amount of testing on your own. You're not going to have a ton of time in-house or with your testing teammates. So for me, also for Grand Prix, this weekend I'm playing in an open that's close by. And so those are tournaments that I am still testing on my own, of course. You have to rely a decent amount online resources, I should say, like Magic Online and Arena, to do some of the games. Because if you don't have another person to sit there across from you and battle against, then that means you have to be able to put in some time to get some data points to draw off of, or you're okay settling for essentially what people are now calling net decking, right? Just kind of copying a deck, but kind of, you know, learning from others. But that's not really testing yourself. That's just kind of using someone else's work or what they're saying and replicating it. So for me, it's kind of a matter of making some time. For me, like having a team, part of the major benefit of that is so that I don't have to be sitting on my computer playing all of these games. But I have gotten into the situations where even if I'm working with a team, like for Worlds, for instance, like I was working with two other people, Brad Nelson and BBD. And so they live in Roanoke, right? So they're close by. They could play against each other whenever they want to. For me, I was still at home. And I was getting into these situations where I wouldn't have someone to play against. I would just kind of find some random cards and just start like get my Sharpie out, proxy up whatever deck, shuffle up, draw an opening hand, realize the deck was garbage, throw it in the trash can, like, and then just kind of go through this process of being like, because at that time it was Red Black Chain Whirler that was the best deck, and I just wanted to go through all of these decks and be like, does this deck beat Red Black Chain Whirler? Nope. Does this deck beat Red Black Chain Whirler? Nope. Does this? And that's sure. Just kind of like, I mean, sometimes it can be frustrating testing by yourself because you have no one to validate your opinions.
Right.
And if you're off, it kind of feels like more risky, but at the same time, it can also be a disadvantage for a big tournament or for an important tournament to be sharing your ideas if they're really good ideas and you're sharing them to a lot of other people. Then that inherently may put you at a disadvantage because there's other people with that same great information.
I like both a lot of what both of you said, and you know, when I look at this question, I think about like the last tournament that I really really tested for, you know, other, and I think of the team RPTQ that was a couple months back. I don't even remember how long it was now, but you know, we kind of established what decks we were going to be on. For this RPTQ, because you're kind of locked in on different seats and things like that. And so, you know, I knew I was going to play blue-white control. And, you know, I had to dedicate time to sit down and play blue white control, kind of like John says. You know, you have to set aside the things you're going to do and figure out, like, what am I trying to learn today? But I think that the advice that I would give on this is you need to hold yourself accountable. You know, one of the things that players will do is they'll go play five matches. They'll walk away. They won't even think about, like, why did I play these five matches? What did I learn from these five matches? And, like, at the end of, like, why are you even playing the games? Is that even testing? What did you learn? And I think that it's so important to just recognize what is going on. And one of the biggest things that happened from that team RPTQ is it taught me to, even though my teammates literally couldn't change, like, anything about what I was doing. You know, I was locked in on blue eye control because that's the deck that I was playing. I still messaged them, this is how I did tonight. This is what I learned. Here's the changes that I'm making. What do you think about this? And you can do that with yourself. You don't have to have teammates to do that. You can still say to yourself, okay, obviously this was garbage. I should not do this. And you can also say, like, this was great. This is what I learned about this. And kind of hold yourself accountable in that way. Seth, you were nodding your head during that.
Yeah, for sure. I was just thinking about this time when I hit rock bottom testing solo, where I didn't want to proxy up decks because I had just, like, run out of proxy fodder or whatever. And everyone, if they're but a lot of pros, if they're testing for major events, they like to keep their identity a secret, in case you're unaware of this. So, like, they'll have these alternative accounts online so that no one knows who you are. And so you can play whatever deck, and it's like kind of theoretically it's valuable to remain unknown for the testing process. So anyways, I had a bunch of different accounts with different decks, and I realized how painful it is to play against yourself on Magic Online and just be like loading up, like click, go to the other screen, click. Like, it's just like flashback and forth between decks. And I mean, people, like you were saying, Spencer, you, like, in that situation where you're testing for a team RPTQ, you at least have your teammates, right? So you have other, like, optimally you have someone you can bounce information off of, right? Even if they're not your opponents for testing, just to, like, relay that. A lot of times I'll be talking to someone and I respect their opinions, even if their accomplishments may be very different than my accomplishments playing the game, but that doesn't mean that their information isn't very valuable to me because they may have a lot more knowledge about a deck or something like that. And so, yeah, just having someone to talk to is definitely valuable. If you have access to that.
To be fair, you know, I think that there's Reddit, right? Like, you can go and make a Reddit post that says, I played Magic Online tonight. Here's the league I played. Here's how I did. Here's the changes that I would make. What do you guys think? And you can get immediate feedback. I don't know how valuable it will be on Reddit, but you can certainly bounce ideas off of people and get that feedback. And I think that the important piece there is that you are holding you accountable. And that's kind of where I was getting with that.
One thing I'd add to what you were saying, Spencer, is sort of to help yourself be accountable. I almost never go into testing without having a question, like a very specific question in my mind. Like, this is what I want to find out about this matchup, or this is what, you know, I want to see if this card is good. Like, I rarely, when I'm testing intensely for like a PT, I don't want to just play a league, write down 4-1 and call it a day. Like, I would, and I think thinking about it after is also very useful, and writing down some notes, but even thinking before the match, like,
right,
what is my goal for this test session? What are the questions I really want to answer? And that will sort of help you during the games of, like, drawing attention to what you need to figure out.
Yeah. Awesome. I really like that question, guys. So this week, I think that due to kind of what we're going to be talking about this week, which is the standard power rankings that we do, we're going to skip hashtag always improving and go directly into the decks. So for those who are new, we're using our power ranking system, which is we award points according to finish at tournaments. So we give 6 points for first, 2 points for second, 4 for top 4, 3 for top 8, 2 for top other 2, and 1 for top 64 if available. The tournaments that we used for this are the SEG Classic, the Online PTQ, and the GP in Milwaukee. So these are the three events since the Pro Tour that had points according to finish. I'm thinking of changing the ranking system to a little bit so that we can include things, because one of the things that happened since then is the mocks. It's the mocks challenge, I should say. And so I'd like to be able to record those results in the future. But with that being said, let's start with the deck that comes in at fifth place with 15 points. We have the white aggro decks. So, Seth, if you want to, could you give us a kind of a simple summary of what this deck is doing in Standard right now?
Sure. So white aggro, I think normally it's mono white splash red for something like Heroic Reinforcements and Experimental Frenzy in the sideboard, but some versions are just straight mono white, a bunch of planes, and just beat down. But this deck is one of, if not the most aggressive deck in the format. It's really weird how quickly the script flips, right? We were just at the Pro Tour, it seems like just yesterday almost, where I was watching the top 8 play out, and the top 4 was all white decks. So yeah. If you were if you were watching the Pro Tour, you know, it was the dominant deck. There was a lot of it there. For me, it's like I was saying, it's a very aggressive deck, which means inherently there's not as much you can do with it in terms of gameplay getting an edge. Like, you're playing out your creatures, you know, you go turn 1 Sky Marcher Aspirant, turn 2 Adanto Vanguard, turn 3 History or Benelish Marshal, and then you just kind of have this curve, 1 mana creature into 2 mana into 3 mana, and then if you have a bunch of things on the board and they stay on the board, like, you're probably going to win that game, you know, if you have a decent draw. So it's a deck that wants to be on the play. It's mostly creatures. You do have your Conclave Tribunals for some interaction, maybe Pride of Conquerors for a little extra punch, but it's mostly small things. So, like, if your opponent has a card like a Goblin Chain Whirler or a Sweeper, that is the best form of interaction in order to combat the deck.
I want to talk really quickly, if we can, guys, about the list that went 8-0 at the Standard Mox. This deck played 23 lands, 2 Ajani's main, no Benelish Marshal, and 4 Heroic Reinforcements main. This is a lot bigger, and it is the Veteran Loxodon version. This is a lot bigger than some of the stuff we saw, you know, that was dominating on Magic Online the week before the Pro Tour. This is way bigger.
Yeah, I was a bit surprised to see no Benelish Marshals and the max Heroic Reinforcements, because Heroic Reinforcements, when we were testing for the Pro Tour, we knew Venerated Luxon was very strong and Heroic Reinforcements was very strong. What we didn't come to was that you could actually play them in the same deck, because the idea is that you play the Heroic Reinforcements and then you just immediately want to smash with everything. You already want to have the rest of your hand in play, so, like, it's not necessarily working that well with the Luxon, but it just turns out that you can, like, the cards are so powerful that even though the synergy between the two isn't perfect, like, and Ajani, by the way, is the card that I have been most afraid of when playing from the Golgari side of it, because if they play it with a decent draw, and it's just this other threat that you have to somehow deal with, but you're already immediately getting some value out of it. And I had it in my Celestia deck, 1 main, 1 sideboard, and it seems like people are really catching on to that being one of the trump cards in that matchup.
So, John, like you, I actually haven't played much of this deck. I've played a couple games with it on Arena, a couple matches with it on Arena, but outside of that, it's just kind of this thing that I play to get gold more than anything, not really something that I'm, like, trying to actively learn. But John, looking at some of the decks, is there anything that stands out to you and that would worry you from some of the Standard decks that you've been playing?
Well, I mean, I have some thoughts on just the white aggro deck in general. So it saw, you're saying basically it saw a big drop off in terms of how well it was doing in recent tournaments. That's
yeah, definitely. The 15-point drop is I mean, it almost didn't even make the top five.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of so I think that does a few things. It tells you that the format is relatively healthy because like Seth was saying, the aggro decks have less room to customize. They sort of, I mean, yes, they didn't play Banished Marshall in the Mox list or whatever, but they're still basically spewing out one drops and trying to kill you quickly. Whereas, you know, the black green and the Jeskai control and other decks like that, and even the Drake deck was starting a main deck like Entrancing Melody to give it a better white weenie matchup. And even if these changes don't make it, you know, don't flip the matchup 180 degrees, you're still increasing your win percentage. So like, I think the white decks are definitely facing an uphill battle right now. I mean, everyone's main decking Wild Growth Walker, stuff like that. But I mean, it's a powerful deck that I think you can still do well with. And it looks like the Mox list, for example, did some things that maybe make it better in the mirror, which could help as well.
Yeah,
but I think it's still a good deck.
What are you going to say, Seth?
Yeah, I was just going to say, going back to the no Banalish Marshall, in a deck that has so few red cards, like you're only playing the Experimental Frenzies in the sideboard as your other red cards, and you have two mountains, like, but those two mountains aren't like completely necessary. They do make it more likely that you're able to cast the heroic reinforcements. So that's the real benefit of having those two mountains, right? Is that you can have 10 red sources and you can cast the heroic reinforcements reliably.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I would assume that your turn four Aurelia draws in the sideboard, like that card is at its best, you know, similar to heroic reinforcements when you can jam it. And so I would assume that I think Pro Points on their podcast, they talked about the percentages. Sam was talking about it. And basically they all wish that they had more mountains.
Yeah, I mean, and you can't have more mountains when you're playing the Banalish Marshall versions, and specifically also the versions with less lands. But Banalish Marshall has been extremely impressive to me. This is a very innovative take on it, because you would think, like, inherently that if you're playing only a couple of red cards, you want to just be playing the version with the Marshalls, but Aurelia is also a great point. The other thing that I want to mention about this deck, though, is that you want to be very cognizant of your curve. And so if you have too many cards at, say, the 4-mana slot, you still need to be able to get something into play early, because if your opponent's still at 20 when you're getting to 4-mana, then you're just kind of playing into a lot of deck's hands. So it's definitely a delicate balance. By cutting the Marshalls, you're kind of you're gambling that you for sure are going to hit your fourth land, but you're still only playing 23 lands. So the chances of that happening, I think something like one third of the time.
Yeah, I think it's 70. I think it's 70% to hit four lands by turn. Is it turn four? Or is it turn five? It's something like that.
Yeah, I think it's something like one third of the time where you're going to miss, right? That four, and if you only really have History of Benalia as your super strong 3-mana play, then, and you're playing some more defensive creatures like Snubhorn Sentry for instance, then your aggression isn't really happening. So you are making the gamble that you are going to get to 4-mana on time.
Yeah, Sentry is an interesting one to me, John, just because, you know, actually just for exactly what Seth is saying, right? Like you're already increasing your curve, and now you're kind of hoping that this like slow Nacaudal gets there. I don't know.
Well, yeah, you're increasing your curve. I mean, you do also have Venerated Loxodon, which is kind of a 3-drop, I guess. Sure. When I first saw Snubhorn Sentry, I was surprised that people would consider that card playable. And I kind of felt that way throughout the PT testing, but then it was turn on almost all the time. So yeah, I mean, you lose out on the early aggression for a creature that can survive like a Fiery Cannonade or whatever.
And Hunted Witness is another 1-drop that I don't even think we saw very much of that card at all at the Pro Tour. And now we've seen it more in the list. So that, So it seems like they're
attacking their hate, right? People are coming after them with things like Shivan Fire out of the sideboard, and they're trying to beat it.
Yeah, I think. Go ahead, Seth.
Yeah, they're trying not to just be cold to a sweeper. Like, I played against Luis Salvato with more of the all-in Boros deck, and I just went one drop, two drop, three drop, and he swept the board, and then the game is over at that point. So some of the creatures here are a bit more resilient to that.
What's the name of that griffin, by the way, Seth?
Is it Skymarcher Griffin? I'm not really sure. It's a 2-mana 2/2 Vigilance. That was the
highlight of that for me. So I just thought.
Oh, when I asked about that.
That was great. All right, so I don't have anything else to add on these white aggro decks. I think that, you know, they are doing a good job of adjusting, right? Like, they were the target the last 2 weeks, and they still stayed in the top five and were able to kind of go through this. I mean, we saw Jake Tilk top eight with the white version. Mono white. He had a main deck Lyra that he said that he got to play on turn four a lot due to his Legion's landings. So, I mean, people are still innovating on these.
I also think that the drop is not indicative of the deck falling out completely. Like, it will probably bounce back as the decks at the top start to cannibalize against each other.
Yeah, I agree.
And for what it's worth, because I'm actually preparing for the World Magic Cup, this is one of the decks that we are definitely considering as part of our gauntlet. If that's something you're interested in watching, coming up in Barcelona in a couple weeks, because it's a very specific format, this Team Unified Standard, but it doesn't overlap with some of the other decks. And that's kind of cool how we've got a number of different decks from different parts of the color pie doing well here.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about a new deck, a deck that I did not expect to be on this list. Like, I am legitimately shocked. And that is Selesnya Tokens. Coming in with 18 points. I just going to ask, why is this deck doing well?
Well, I mean, my first thoughts, I played against this deck before the PT a fair bit, and I was testing Mono Red at the time. And it's just, in one way, it's a more resilient White Weenie deck. Like, it has a lot of the same cards, Adanto Vanguard, Venerated Loxodon. But I think, like, a key card that sort of brings it over the top is March of the Multitudes. It's just such a good response to, you know, the big sorceries or someone playing a Teferi or someone tapping out for a Crackling Drake, or whatever Golgari card gets played. It's a card, like, whenever I was playing against it, I'm like, well, I'm going to probably beat them if they don't have March. And I would think that a lot. And once in a while they'd have March and I would lose. So maybe that's why it's like just a bigger White Weenie deck.
Yeah, for me, I was very surprised. A spoiler of the list here is that there's no mono red deck. I was kind of suspecting to see like mono red in the top five standard decks because we've just been so used to Goblin Chain Whirler and the deck was still pretty heavily played at the Pro Tour. But anyways, instead we've got this Selesnya Tokens deck, which is pretty new. I believe it won an SCG Classic.
Yeah, Nick Prince won the SCG Classic with it.
Yeah. And since then it has picked up, like, decks can go from 0 to 100 super fast. Like, one person wins a tournament and then, you know, boom, boom, boom. Like, the same thing we can talk about later. The Jeskai list,
yeah,
that's popular right now. But like, one person does well with something and then it's just kind of it has this effect on the metagame. And like John was mentioning, March is the super powerful card where you don't need to be this all-in aggressive deck anymore. You can sit back. You don't have to make these huge attacks. And you're always threatening to your opponent, all right, later in the game, yep, I'll March, and then I'll Flourish, and then I'll kill you. And that's just like, all right. Like, you know, like, as a Golgari player, there's really not that much you can do. Like, I mean, they're gonna get to these late game situations where they can just have like these two cards, like maybe it's a Tristani plus March or just March into March, where you say you make 5 tokens and then you make 15 or whatever. And it's right. Just like, you know, they snowball really well. So I think March is the most powerful card of the deck, and it's what makes the deck tick.
Yeah. One of the things that I've been playing in if you're a patron of Constructor Criticism, you're going to the Constructor Critics group, you saw a list that I recently fight-o'd with that had Flower Flourish in it. It was kind of a combination of Seth's deck from the Pro Tour and the deck that took 10th at the GP right before the Pro Tour. And, you know, Flower Flourish is just... It's so interesting to be able to play as many different like sources in a deck that relies so heavily on things like History of Benalia and wants history to hit every time. And Flower makes that so much easier. And then kind of like Seth said, on the flip side, sometimes you just march, untap, flourish them, and they're like, well, I was never going to win this game. So that's another one that I've been really impressed with. And if you look at the list from 32nd in Milwaukee from Michael Simon, you also see two Ajani's again. So,
yeah.
I mean, these lists can... One of the things that I think that the green-white decks have is they can play a mid-range game that the white-weenie decks have a harder time playing. So.
Yeah, but Ajani being able to bring back creatures is, like, I think most players just use it tick up, tick up, tick up. In this list, being able to bring back an Amara is nice. And then going back to the white deck, being able to bring back Takatli
right
against Golgari. So, yeah, definitely a very versatile Planeswalker there.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the next deck because we have a huge... jump in points for our top three decks, guys. We go from 18 points to 41 points coming in for Blue Red Phoenix. Why don't you give us a simple summary of what these Blue Red Phoenix decks are doing, John?
Okay, well, they have very, I guess you would call it, I don't know if this is someone's term, but I would call it momentum, where you're just casting a lot of spells that are eventually turning the Drake you play into a game-ending threat. Or bringing back an Arclight Phoenix for free. And that sort of lets you just cycle through your deck, find the right lands, find the right cards, and then burn them out, basically. It's just a very efficient deck, and it sees a lot of cards. So if it's got some good sideboard cards, it will see those a lot. Yeah.
I actually think that's like a very key in this deck. And so this is the deck that I played a lot recently, and it's so easy to find your sideboard cards. And it's one of the reasons that I think that it's such a good Niv-Mizzet deck, because if you're boarding in something like Niv-Mizzet, that card is very good in the matchups that you're bringing it in. And you're going to see your Niv-Mizzets a lot. You're going to see your Murmuring Mystics a lot. And that's really powerful. Being able to have these really high end cards and just almost, I mean, see them such a higher percentage of the time than people that are bringing in their high-end cards for the matchup is, that's a big deal for a deck.
I think also just the, like, this, I mean, the list I'm looking at right now has 21 lands, which is probably the normal, I would guess. But the fact that a deck with 21 lands can board into Niv-Mizzet and start using their card selection to hit their land drops in order to play this sort of game-winning card, whereas in game ones, maybe they're more streamlined and they're looking for spells. It's a lot of flexibility, and you couldn't do that without having all these, you know, scry effects.
Yeah. I mean, is the list that you're looking at the Owen Turtenwald list that top eight in?
Yes.
Yeah. That list is really good. I know that a lot of our listeners have been playing that recently. You know, one of the cards that has impressed me the most, Seth, in the main deck of the list that I've been playing is also in Seth's list, which is Beacon Bolt. That card is... just feels like a double murder sometimes.
Yeah, it's a really strong card, basically, in most of your matchups. And even against Jeskai now, being that that the Jeskai decks have big creatures in them in a lot of cases, it's actually just not a dead card in most of your matchups at all. So yeah, I've been impressed with Beacon Bolt. I actually talked to Owen about his experience at the Grand Prix, and he did not lose a single game where he kept seven cards. That's what he told me. With the deck, you know, he only lost to Mulligans. So the deck is that to me showcases, well, obviously Owen's a great player. We don't have to talk about that, but it just has this kind of power level where if you have a good draw with your Phoenix deck, you're probably going to beat the good draw or the medium draw of any other deck. because getting those Arclight Phoenixes into the graveyard and getting them into play early in the game and then snowballing that with more cantrips and removal is just super hard for any deck to be able to beat. So if you're playing against the Phoenix deck, you're really just kind of crossing your fingers that they don't have that nutty draw to a certain extent.
So I promised the listeners, some of the listeners, that we would talk about this on the show. So, John, you've played a fair bit of Phoenix. You know, I've played a fair bit of Jeskai and a fair bit of Phoenix. I'm sure, Seth, you've played, you know, a fair bit of both of the decks. What's favored? Who is favored in the Niv-Mizzet control mirror, quote unquote, or these blue red mirrors between Jeskai and these Izzet decks?
Well, I mean, I guess a lot's going to depend on what versions of each you're playing. Probably more so in terms of the Jeskai deck, I guess. When I was playing the Drake deck, I felt a little bit behind against Jeskai. So I guess I'd probably put Jeskai ahead. I think it gets better post side where I can play my Niv-Mizzets. I feel like I don't have enough threats. Although I'm good against some of their removal. But anyway, even though I felt behind, I would often run them out of answers and then land a Crackling Drake and then they're just dead. So
yeah, so that's been my experience. And when they were playing Enigma Drake, I felt so far behind because oftentimes they could just like maximize velocity, kill me. And I was just like, well, that was like a whole lot of nothing that just happened to like kill me out of the blue. And it was really hard to deal with Enigma Drake and that and their card advantage from Goblin Electromancer. However, I have noticed since they went away from the Enigma Drake that my win percentage against this deck has gone up with Jeskai. What are your thoughts, Seth?
Yeah, it's a super interesting matchup where I feel like at the start of the format, I thought that the Arclight Phoenix deck was super far ahead because it's really hard to interact with the Phoenixes themselves. And then you get to sideboard in these counter spells and these other cards that are really tough to deal with. But like you're saying, Spencer, the lists, the Arclight lists have slowly been putting more removal spells in their deck, mm-hmm. like more Lava Coil and Trancing Melody, especially cards like Lava Coil, where you're not necessarily doing as powerful things yourself, and without kind of the velocity as that top end play, it's you're getting yourself into these late game situations against Jeskai, which makes, I believe, the Phoenix deck is not favored in game one, and then after sideboard, it's really tricky. It's a close matchup. I think it's pretty skill intensive from both directions because there's a lot going on, especially in the post sideboard games. But Jeskai players who know the matchup will probably have cards like Seal Away, some sort of exile effect, because from the Jeskai side, you do need to be able to permanently deal with those Arclight Phoenixes.
Yeah, this is a deck that I've had a lot of fun with recently. But that matchup's one that's really I think interesting is the right word. Like it becomes about different things at different parts of the games, depending on how the players play the game. So the player can make it about Niv-Mizzet. The player can make it about Mario's Conjecture. The player can make it about, they probably can't make it about Teferi in this matchup, but you know, they can make it about different things, right? They can make it about their counter spells. And that's interesting that I don't know the other matchups in this standard format have. So.
Yep. And that's going to be the case when you got this kind of blue, somewhat aggressive deck against blue control. It's going to be some sort of counterspell / disruption against more controlling elements. And those are, I prefer to be on the slightly more aggressive deck because if you're able to, you really have to be able to get something onto the board, right? That's your goal, is get something onto the board with your Izzet Drake deck. It's harder to get a Crackling Drake to resolve, and without the Enigma Drakes, there's not as many of these top-end plays until you get to Niv-Mizzets, but the Jeskai deck is probably also going to have Niv-Mizzets, so that's kind of a wash. So for me, it's getting an Arclight Phoenix onto the board and then just kind of sitting back, and post-board, there should be enough ways to kind of protect it.
John, any additional thoughts on this deck?
Yeah, no, I think we're really seeing the metagame develop into sort of a three decks at the top. And I feel like the Phoenix deck is kind of slightly behind against Jeskai, slightly ahead against Golgari, but those percentages can definitely be switched if they're playing different versions. There's a lot of play to all the matchups, and I do think that Enigma Drake does give you a better shot against Jeskai in particular, just like making sure you can stick something.
Yeah, so if you had asked me, I don't know, 3 days ago what my thoughts were, I would have said, maybe even 2 days ago, I probably would have said, like, Drake's is favored. I don't even know that it was close in my mind. But the last couple of days, the games that I've been playing with the newer versions of these Phoenix decks, I haven't felt that way. It's been a grind. I think the Jeskai lists have gotten a lot better too. They've been put through the ringer these last couple weeks as people have tried to improve them since up to Milwaukee and now after. So let's talk about Jeskai really quick. This deck does come in with 48 points coming in second place. And man, this deck, I mean, even if we take the fact that the crazy version from, the crazy version one, which, by the way, is getting more popular. But that being said, this deck dominated GP Milwaukee. And that's with, what was it, 4 Golgari decks in the top 8? Like, this deck had something like 12 decks in the top 32 or something. It was an extremely dominant performance by Jeskai Control. What caused this deck to do so well, Seth?
It's the best late game deck in the format, and in a format that's slowing down and you're able to sit back behind card advantage and removal, and you have an insane top end play with Nimizzet, you have a sweeper in Deafening Clarion. The deck really has everything that you could want from a deck in this format. So, I mean, there's certainly an argument for it being the best deck. And you said the crazy version won. I would argument that the best version.
Oh, tell me more, Seth.
I mean, I've just been super impressed with the deck that Adrian Sullivan innovated. And if I was going to play the regular draw go version of Jeskai, how do you possibly beat the other version of Jeskai with the 4 Nimizzets and the 4 treasure maps? Like, you're just sitting there and playing Nimizzet and you're just like, okay, yeah, that resolves. Do I have anything that can kill it? Yeah. Maybe I have like one or two removal spells. Maybe you kill the first one and then they just play another one and then you go to the next game. So you're already down a game in the matchup and then you're like, it's just like, yeah, it's just miserable. And then Nimizzet also gives you a big edge against, well, not a huge edge, but it definitely gives you some percentage points against the Drake stack as well. And, you know, so yeah, I've been impressed by it. Yeah.
All right. Well, you know,
really impressed with treasure map in particular. When I was playing the Drake stack against, I played against Mono Red 4 or 5 times at the SCG, and I would just destroy them every single time. Unless they played an early treasure map, in which case I would often lose a long game. And that card has just really impressed me. And I'm not surprised that it's seeing play in a control deck.
I got my butt kicked by treasure map just like 2 minutes before this podcast started. You know, it's funny because when the card was spoiled, everybody, that was like one of the hype, right? Like that card was, people were talking about that. And, you know, it turned out that you could play maybe a couple in your sideboard of something like red black sometimes, but it kind of underperformed a lot. But now that you can flip it and, you know, maybe ramp into something like Niv-Mizzet or just draw a bunch of extra cards in this format, it's pretty cool. Have you guys listened to podcasts by chance? Either of you? Actually, I don't know.
Only on road trips, pretty much.
Sure. So I just listened to another podcast by the Pro Points podcast. And one of the things that they were talking about was kind of combining some of the things that Sam was doing with some of the things that Adrian was doing. What's really interesting is if we are coming to the point, Seth, where the best Niv-Mizzet deck is just the best deck?
You know, It's possible. I think we've got these insane six mana cards. I still believe that Carnage Tyrant is another very viable direction you can go in, but the games are not just ending by turn three or four. We're even seeing the aggressive decks slow down, so that makes these haymakers that much more powerful. And yeah, we've seen Sam Black brew up these more controlling, longer game decks, that because he's a deck builder, he can find these weird cards like Treasure Map, and I would argue also Karn has been starting to see some more play as well. That I've always been high on, but Treasure Map is one of those cards that hadn't been seeing very much play, if like maybe out of the sideboard of some decks, but now we're seeing it a lot more, even beyond just Jeskai and in the main decks. And if you're playing a deck that is trying to go long, you can, not only is it just pure card advantage and that you get the scry, these decks can presumably also make use of these treasures. So yeah, we're seeing cards like that, and we're seeing longer games in general, which I'm enjoying. Like from the Golgari side, and there's only one deck.
Yeah, there's obviously Golgari is going to come in at first. And actually, that's a great transition, Seth, which is, with the format is going longer, where does that leave Golgari? Is Golgari okay with that?
You know, I think Golgari is. It's a mid-range deck, but it can, a lot of the matchups, you're kind of playing the more controlling deck. And then against Jeskai, you are trying to kind of get some things into play, but it's a very delicate balance, right? You never want to leave yourself too vulnerable to a sweeper, and especially after sideboard, you do have these forms of disruption, like your duresses, some type of removal for Nimizzet or Teferi in case they do play a threat is very important, because that allows you to kind of not have just creatures of your own. And then cards like Carnage Tyrant, we're talking about these six mana cards that are super powerful that cannot be countered, cannot really be, and Carnage Tyrant is one that very few cards can actually deal with it. So from the Golgari side, I think you just kind of have to be willing to play a little bit of a longer game with the Jeskai deck.
John, you said that we have you said that we're coming up on a three deck format. I assume this means, you know, you think those three decks are Golgari, Jeskai, and Drakes. And I think our points agree with you. What is your initial take on this Golgari deck and where it sits in the format?
Well, so I think the move for the Jeskai decks to play more Niv-Mizzet is actually playing right into Golgari's hands. Like they have. That's not a card that I think is even good against Golgari.
Yeah, Ravenous Chupacabra just kind of blows that out of the water most of the time.
And Vivian Reed, and I think they can now justify playing more copies of Vivian Reed, which is great in the format. I think that, you know, you play your Carnage Tyrant, they play their Niv-Mizzet, then you just play a Vivian Reed and kill it. You're so far ahead. That's not to say that they have to go all in on the Niv-Mizzet plan. Like, they can play a Teferi control deck as well. I think like the Golgari deck has good sideboard options. I think I always jam for duress in my, you know, mid range in my black green decks. Like, it seems like sometimes people play two or three, and I'm like, I'm always playing four. That's the card I want the most against a control deck. So they can customize. They can play Doom Whisperer if that ends up being in a good spot, or more Carnage Tyrants, more removal. Like, they have a lot of flexibility. So I think Golgari's position near the top is pretty stable. I could see the Drake deck falling off, for example, because I think, you know, decks might find a way to deal with it, more lava coils or whatever. But I think Golgari and Jeskai are going to be pillars of the format going forward.
Yeah, I think that they are the two top two decks. And then I have Drake's as more of a distant third, despite what the numbers here might indicate. And like what John's saying is definitely true. Like in game ones, if the Jeskai deck is playing a bunch of creatures, that happens to potentially make your Ravenous Chupacabras all of a sudden look really good when they wouldn't be good at all. So that being said, the new versions do have cards that are pretty darn good against Golgari, like Treasure Map, if you're able to play that on turn two. And then there's also sometimes, you know, a savvy Jeskai player is going to try to set up a situation where they can play Nimizzet and either play multiple spells right after it or have a dive down to protect it. And if they do have a dive down, then that can, you know, really flip things. So
one thing that I'm noticing that I'd love to talk about with Golgari specifically with you guys is we're getting really close to, like, one of the things that Golgari had going for it before was, you know, there was tons of different, you know, decks would be 15, 17 cards off. The deck that just 8-0'd the Mox, I think it's 7 cards off in your from your main deck, Seth, from the GP. It's playing two Seeker Squires instead of two Karns. It's playing two Memorial Follies instead of two.
Already worse than Seth's deck.
Wait, you cut the Karns?
He did cut the Karns. And it's playing an extra Midnight Reaper, and I think... Were you playing three Tyrants? Is that what you were doing?
Yeah, I had three Tyrants.
Yeah. So, I mean, this deck's less than 10 cards off from your list. And it's also less than a couple cards off from some of the popular Golgari streamers lists. Like, are we coming to a unified black-green deck?
Yeah, we're pretty close to being there. I think I'm in the minority playing Druid of the Cows and Karns, and this list is just kind of the stock-ish list. I think the Doom Whisperer package was a one-hit, like, wonder type thing where it was popular for a week, and then people just realized that it is good if you're expecting, what, like, the decks that are at the bottom of the totem pole, but not against the top couple decks.
So I have a thought about that specific comment, because that's something that a lot of players like to do in their decks. They like to play these cards that are good against kind of random decks. And I've always thought that when I'm playing a deck like Golgari, I don't need to play those type of cards because, you know, these green-black mid-range decks, I'm going to win a lot off of my own card quality. And for me, I have never really liked, you know, the you know, a 5-mana 6/6 flyer that does nothing when it enters the battlefield in these type of decks. You know, I'm happy to see it go. I think that the way that you win most of your games is just from having better cards than your opponents.
Yeah, I mean, it has its moments where it looks really nice, like if you're able to get into situations where you dig through most of your deck, but, you know, the deck is full of explore creatures. That's one of the main ways you're also setting up your draws. So, and with these cards like Midnight Reaper and in some cases Karn, you should have enough gas that you're like the main reason why Doom Whisperer could be good is not because it's a 5-mana 6/6, because there's plenty of cards that can deal with a 5-mana 6/6, but the fact that you can kind of set up your draws. But Golgari shouldn't be a deck like, yes, you can get flooded or you can get mana screwed, but the way that the deck is built should inherently kind of allow you to have plenty of plays on turns 7, 8, and 9, even without being able to set up your top card.
John, you know, we're talking about Doom Whisperer not being great. You said that was one of the best cards against you in Vegas, you know, when you're playing the Drake's deck.
Well, I mean, I was playing a version that didn't have Beacon Bolt main deck, so Doom Whisperer was kind of just locked me out game one.
Oh, sure. That makes sense.
I mean, there it is a vulnerable card when there's a lot of things like Vivian Reed in the format. But it's also, you know, really good against some of the other decks like White Weenie, and they need like a binding or something right away, or a Conclave, whatever, Tribunal. Yeah. I definitely see the merit for not playing it. I do think it's a package to keep in mind. If answers start being shaved or the metagame shapes up in a certain way. But yeah, Carnage Tyrant's been really impressive.
Yeah.
For me, the weakest card in these Golgari lists is Seeker Squire, and it's a card that I haven't been playing with. It does work with your Wildgrowth Walkers, but a lot of the times it's just a mopey creature.
You don't like 2-mana 2/3s, bro?
I mean, what format? In draft or in standard? Like,
I'm just kidding.
You know, I mean, 2 mana, 2/3. Like, yeah, I mean, it's... I'd rather play a 2 mana, 1/3 that can make a green mana, you know?
Especially since it can play your Karn eternally.
Yeah, I mean, it works with your Wild Growth Walker, which I think is why players kind of get caught up on playing it. All right, I need a critical number of explore things because I want to play 4 Wild Growth Walkers.
Yeah.
But
I don't think that play pattern is real. I think that the true power of Wild Growth Walker in certain matchups is when you can get it back with a Jade Light Ranger with a find and just play them the following, like, right away. That's almost always when my Wild Growth Walkers have been the best.
Yeah. I don't think I've played Secret Squire and been like, wow, this card is just everything I wanted. So, yeah. Still probably unlikely to play it. And if I play it in my Golgari list, assuming I play Golgari at the World Magic Cup, I would play probably just one copy.
All right. Anything you guys want to say before we wrap this up on this standard format? And these, I mean, kind of a surprising 5 decks considering Mono Red wasn't in there. We have tokens coming in, and then just kind of a dominance in the top 3 decks.
Well, I'm not that surprised. Well, I guess I'm surprised that Mono Red's not there from a... I still think a lot of people were playing it last weekend, but I'm not surprised that it was doing badly. I think it has a lot of bad matchups, and the bad matchups are quite bad. And even the matchups that you would think are good are really building an anti-aggro package into their deck, so it's even worse. And people have an answer ready for Experimental Frenzy, which is the main reason you're winning in the first place. So, yeah, I mean, I think Standard is healthy, though. I think, like, you can play aggro, mid-range, control pretty easily. And I expect the metagame to continue to shift.
Yep, I mean, I've been enjoying Standard a lot. Like, I'm not that surprised, considering how many weeks we are into the format, that the metagame is a little bit more defined, and these are kind of... I wouldn't suspect too many changes in terms of these decks in until we hit the next set. But even within, you know, these top 5 decks, there's still plenty of card choices to play around with. Plenty of ways to maneuver your deck to try to... maybe it's just swapping out a couple cards here or there to try to make specific matchups better. And the games themselves, I've... like, playing Golgari, I was just like... it felt like I was behind every single game until somehow I was turning the corner and, you know, doing all of these things later in the game. So it's... the main takeaway for me, looking at the deck lists, and I already mentioned it earlier, but the format is getting to a place where games aren't being won as much by turn 4. It's turns 6 and beyond, more so. So that is enjoyable to me. I like, you know, getting a chance to play Magic. So, and I believe that this standard format is allowing that to happen.
Well, I'm thoroughly enjoying the standard format as well. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening this week. That's going to wrap it up for our power rankings. You can go to patreon.com/ccmtg, become a patron of the show. We got to get ourselves some of those construct tokens for Seth before Karn rotates. So head over there, get that done. Did you decide your token, John?
The only thing I thought of so far was Thopters, because I think they're kind of cool. But I'm going to think about it a little bit more.
Okay. You can find me at Spencer38. You can find Seth at Seth Manfield. You can currently find John at John Stern MTL. You can find the podcast at CCMTG. You can join the conversation by joining the Constructive Criticism family on Facebook. If you're a patron of $12 or more, you get access to the Constructive Critics group, where you can see sideboard guides for, you know, for decks like green black decks, like, is it, you know, Drake's? That's a great place to get some information, talk to other people trying to improve. You can also join the Discord, where we'll be doing a contest next month. So you just click, there should be a link in the show notes, or you can go to the bios page at constructivecriticism.com. Also, we launched a bunch of new products in the swag store. So if you don't have the money to be a patron, one of the things you can do, you can go buy a t-shirt, you know, kicks us a couple bucks, super helpful. We really appreciate it. So thank you, everybody, so much for listening this week, and we'll see you guys all next week.
magic, magic, magic.